This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What to do with all the terrible news about our planet? I have selections from two programs to help. First up are Anna Jane Joyner and Marianne Hitt and their podcast, No Place Like Home. Sponsored by the Sierra Club, their new series gets local action to fight off eco-anxiety. It helped me. Then we go to scientist Rob Muir and his show, Environmental Dialogues, as broadcast on the Voice America Variety Channel. Rob interviews UK philosopher Rupert Reed and academic gone activist Alison Green to get the latest about the viral action group Extinction Rebellion. It's activism for you this week with Radio EcoShock.
Hi, I'm Anna Jane Joyner, a climate activist living on the Gulf Coast of Alabama.
And I'm Marianne Hitt, climate activist and director of Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, living in the West Virginia Hills. And this is No Place Like Home, a show that gets to the heart of climate change.
Today, we're launching our brand new season, All the Climate Feels.
Climate change can make us feel a lot of things, freaked out, paralyzed, anxious, angry, sad, even depressed. And so this season, No Place Like Home is going there.
Join us as we get personal with experts and people on the front lines to find out how they're coping and what we can all do to find strength, peace, courage, and even joy in the face of climate change.
Today, we are exploring a phenomenon called eco-anxiety by experts. It's a fairly recent psychological disorder that's affecting an increasing number of people who are worried about the environmental crisis. So what is eco-anxiety? Is it even real? And how do we deal with it?
We talk with Dr. Renee Lertzman, an expert on eco-anxiety. In this episode, we turn to her to explore how climate change affects us emotionally.
But first, Anna Jane and I have some catching up to do. Anna Jane, how are you?
Oh my gosh, I am doing pretty well, all things considered. I'm so excited to be back podcasting with you. I've missed you and I've missed our listeners.
I know. I'm so excited. No Place Like Home is back and I'm back talking with you. And we have such a exciting season in store for folks.
And how have you been doing?
Well, I have been great on many levels. You know, this is a beautiful world and we had a nice family vacation to Montana, to Yellowstone and Glacier before the glaciers are all gone. And also some of the sad things. My dog died, which was, as you know, my fellow dog lover, very heartbreaking. And, you know, work is hard. I mean, trying to keep moving from coal to clean energy in the Trump era is very stressful. And then when you add onto that the stress of our political, larger political climate, sometimes it's just hard to put one foot in front of the other. There's a lot to be thankful for, but it also feels hard right now. It feels hard.
Yeah, I totally feel you. It's been a rough couple of weeks and I'm kind of in a similar boat. Like it's just the beginnings of fall and it's beautiful and there's so much to be thankful for. But these past couple of weeks have just been brutal. I have literally done yoga pretty much every single day just to stay sane and, you know, really try to unplug and not just watch the news 24/7. But even in taking those self-care precautions, I had a day where I just had to take off work, you know, and I just had to separate myself from all of it because it is so emotionally overwhelming. And I'm really glad we're having this conversation about anxiety and how to cope with it, because the world feels quite heavy and hard right now on a lot of levels. And I just think it's so important to explore ways to, you know, to stay healthy and sane in the midst of all this madness.
And you, like many people, have been experiencing not just political and metaphysical storms, but actual real life storms. You were in the midst of some hurricanes this summer. I'm so glad that you're okay.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that has been a rough hurricane season and we are still in it. I just get really like physically stressed out, you know, like my body is tight. I have a hard time breathing. And just all the anxiety around all the preparation, you know, my 9-year-old grandfather lives two houses down. So the evacuation plan is much more complicated because of that. And just the anxiety of thinking about losing your home and losing, you know, we live on this place that's been in my family for over a century. And that's so emotionally and personally meaningful to us. It's just like logistically difficult to deal with these storms. And it's like emotionally exhausting. Yeah, it was rough. And that was just a baby storm. And then of course, I go up to visit my family in North Carolina the week after that happened, because it was my dad's 69th birthday. Happy birthday, Daddy. And then Florence, this monster storm starts while I'm in North Carolina, starts barreling towards the North and South Carolina coast. And I'm like, you know, we're doing birthday celebrations and I'm looking at the news and all my friends who are meteorologists and following this. And they're like, this is really serious. This is bad. And it was really bad. You know, one of my sisters had to evacuate down here from Charleston. It just hit almost straight on to my parents' beach house just north of Wilmington. And we really weren't sure if we were going to have a beach house at the end of that. And we were lucky we still do and had pretty minor damage, all things considering. But, you know, my dad's really upset because that's like his favorite place in the world. And we're all, you know, not just worried about the coast, but worried about flooding in Charlotte and Asheville, where the rest of my family lives. And, you know, I'm checking in with my dad and my brother and sister who stayed in the Carolinas just to make sure that they're safe. And yeah, the whole thing was a harrowing couple of weeks of extreme anxiety.
Oh, well, I am so sorry. Yeah, that just sounds so stressful and so scary and so all consuming. And you're not alone. I am sure that some of our listeners had those experiences this summer, whether it was those huge storms on the Atlantic coast or the fires in the West, which again, I mean, there is, you know, a lot of people describing this as the summer that never was in the West in some places, because they'd like could literally practically breathe all summer long. So, you know, climate change is real and it's landing on our doorsteps today. It's not a problem for our grandchildren. And a lot of people are waking up to this and really struggling with it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I've heard not even just like witnessing my own family and friends' anxiety around both wildfires and hurricanes, a lot of our listeners have reached out to us to share how, you know, how freaked out this is living in a climate change world. And it's, you know, it's scary. So I'm really, really glad that we are grappling with not only anxiety and eco-anxiety, but also what we do with it. You know, we still live, and despite all of these harrowing, scary things happening in the world is still beautiful and full of life and love. And I have to remind myself a lot these days to stay connected to those things as well, because there is so much to be joyful about and to be thankful for. And I think I'm really excited to talk to folks about what we do with these emotions and you know, the kind of severe mental challenges that they're presenting to more and more people, but also what are some positive things that we can do to move through them and to help navigate them. So I'm really excited to jump into this season.
Me too. And also, you know, as someone who is an advocate who does this for a living, how you keep doing the work in the midst of some of those kind of overwhelming feelings, because we got to keep doing the work and we've got to do it from a good place. So we can't wait to share the season with you, and we'll be back right after this.
Hi, my name is Marina and I'm from Longview, Texas. Here's one way I stay sane in the face of climate change. I think a lot about my place on the earth and my connection to the earth. Concepts like Joanna Macy's, the web of life cradles us and calls us to weave it further. This helps me feel like more than a carbon footprint. Then when I'm still and feeling connected, I sit in this awareness and pray for the earth, for solutions. I spend time visualizing a healed world. I try to tend to my grief as it arises and make it a discipline to talk to the people around me about climate change and my reactions. For so long, I struggled with guilt for my personal contributions, even after taking lots of steps to simplify and lower my footprint. Now I focus more on being a voice for the earth and helping by being a part of the many voices pushing for solutions.
So, Anna Jane, I want to kick this off by sharing some highlights with you from a really fascinating conversation I had with a woman who you know, who has been studying eco-anxiety for decades.
Ah, I'm so excited. You talked to Renee Lertzman, right? Or Dr. Renee Lertzman, I should say. How did the interview go?
It was really incredible. Renee, you know her, but she is such a committed and thoughtful and really profound leader who has been looking at the intersection of psychology, essentially, and climate change, and looking at how that affects our mental health, both in terms of how we respond to climate change, but also how it kind of interferes sometimes with our ability to do anything about it. So, you know, for me as both a mom and a person living in this world, but also as an advocate, it was really an incredible conversation. But basically, you know, the concept is that, you know, we all know that we are hurting the planet, and it gives people these complicated emotions like being sad or feeling overwhelmed or feeling apathy or, you know, grief once you kind of realize what is going on. And so I visited her. She lives out in the Bay Area, and I was out in San Francisco for the Global Climate Action Summit in September. And that was when I visited her and had this conversation.
Yeah, I'm so excited to hear more. I want to know, like, how did she get started? Like, what brought her to this kind of intersection of psychology and climate change and eco-anxiety?
Well, that was fascinating. So she was in college. It was back in the 80s, and she was taking classes in psychology and then also in environmental studies. And it really struck her confusing as to why these two disciplines were so separate from each other.
So I was experiencing incredible anxiety and all kinds of distress over what I was learning in my environmental studies class. And the way it was being presented struck me as a bit strange, in that, you know, every week we would have these lectures about all kinds of just incredible ecological crises, whether it was, you know, about deforestation or species loss, mountaintop, you know, removal. And it would be in these lectures hearing about all the issues, and then everyone would just sort of leave and go about our day, and as if it was not utterly devastating and traumatic things to be learning about, especially as a young person, but at any age. And then I would go over to my psychology class, and again, you know, social psychologist, very well known, talking only about the classic kind of human psychological issues. We were looking at aggression and prejudice and themes that are really big in social psychology, attitudes and beliefs and all of that. And of course, none of it was touching on what was going on with our relationship to the world and to the environment. And so it just became very clear to me that there was something profoundly missing here.
So she went on to make it her life's mission to try to connect those dots and, you know, help people tap into essentially the emotional and psychological components of the environmental movement, which I can tell you as an advocate who's been doing this work for 20 years is very rare. And honestly, when I was sitting there talking to her, it was kind of an aha moment that not only had I not ever thought about that before, but then it sort of struck me as, well, why? Why have I never thought about the sort of the behavioral and psychological elements of this? So she made that her mission to connect those dots.
It's so fascinating and so personally relevant to my life. You know, I come from an amazing family of brilliant, artistic, kind, crazy people, but we also, one of the gifts and curses of my lineage is that a lot of us struggle with pretty severe anxiety, like pretty much like one out of two of us on my mom's side of the family has struggled with some sort of issue around mental health and anxiety or depression. And so I think I would have a high level of anxiety, even if it was like a perfect world full of rainbows and no climate change all the time. But I will say that going into this field was definitely a complicating factor, because it is, you know, just going to work every day trying to save humanity from a suicide mission is pretty emotionally intense work. And I remember kind of in my like early to mid career thinking about how there really does need to be better kind of emotional support and mental health support for activists who are just immersed in these massive problems, you know, all the time for our everyday living and life. I know for me, I've had bouts with really bad panic attacks and panic disorder, which almost always is connected to my work. That's like when they became most prevalent. It's one of the reasons we left New York, is I was having panic attacks, you know, anywhere from like 3 to 5 times a week. And I just had this like visceral thing inside me that was like, you have to get out of this situation. And I left my amazing but very intense job as the, you know, working in the climate space, and came down to Alabama to live on the ocean and kind of continue to work on climate change because it's my calling and my passion. But I just needed to figure out a more sustainable way of doing it, because I realized that if I kept going at that rate without taking care of my mental health and my even my physical health, then I was going to burn out and I wouldn't be able to continue to help, you know, fight climate change. So I'm really, really fascinated by these intersections, and they have personally big themes in my life. And I'm grateful to hear Renee's story and to be having this open conversation about it, because I don't think we talk about it enough.
Well, I am sorry very much to hear about how hard that has been for you. And I expect a lot of our listeners can relate too. I did ask Renee about that, about where you start to connect those dots between the emotional things that are at play under the surface when it comes to climate change. Here's what she had to say.
I think number one is to recognize environmental issues, and that includes climate issues, as in fact emotionally complicated, that these issues are going to be complicated for each one of us in very different ways, depending on who you are, where you're coming from. So it's not generalizing to say everyone is equally as freaked out as everyone else. But I think the first thing is to, number one, recognize that these are emotionally charged issues, and that if you are experiencing anxiety, fear, anger, that whole range of emotions, to know that that's totally natural and it makes complete sense. So that itself, I think, can be a powerful intervention for people, because it helps just normalize that, okay, if I'm feeling these things, there's nothing wrong with me. And chances are that a lot of other people are feeling this way too, but we're not talking about it.
It's so good. I'm just so grateful. This world is so crazy complicated and weird and harmful in a lot of ways. And, you know, looking at climate change and looking at the Kavanaugh hearings and looking at all of these layers and dynamics that are troubling and disturbing, it makes sense that we are struggling with anxiety and depression. We would almost be crazy not to be.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, even for people who aren't feeling all of this in such an intense way, I think that to sort of go to the opposite extreme as climate activists, we can sometimes shut down the emotional side of this issue altogether, maybe because we just feel like it's sort of too much to bear. But what Renee was saying when I talked with her is that if we don't face our feelings, however intense they may be, whether they're as intense as yours or maybe less so in the case of for other folks, and just take a look at those, that we aren't taking action in as sort of as strong and powerful a way as we could. So let's listen to that.
You know, like real resilience and capacity has to include our ability to bring our full selves. And that includes our feelings. And that includes the conflicts that might come up, the ambivalence, the anxiety, all those things that I talk a lot about. That's resilience. That's health. That's being an integrated human and an integrated professional. You know, I was just at the Global Climate Action Summit, where it was sort of a quick exposure to how even, you know, at a very high level, leaders around the world are thinking and talking about these issues. And what I noticed was a emphasis on solutions and action. You know, it's even in the name Global Climate Action Summit. And my sense was there wasn't nearly enough attention on what are the capacities that we need to be really cultivating in ourselves and with the communities we're working with.
So she mentions the Global Climate Action Summit, and that was a big event with business leaders, world leaders, philanthropists, you know, making big commitments around the United States meeting its Paris climate commitment, which is obviously a critical thing to be doing in the era of Trump. There were also folks who were outside protesting the event because of the urgency of the climate crisis. They felt that it wasn't going far enough, and that some of the leaders who were in the room could have been doing a lot more. So it was high profile, very intense, kind of an experience. within the venue itself, there certainly was not much talk about the emotional side of this for many speakers, although Jane Goodall talked in a very moving way about her view of this work as spiritual work. And I thought that was one of the moments where it really kind of broke through.
When I'm out in the rainforest, I have a spiritual connection because you understand the interconnectedness of all things, where every little species has a role to play. And so protecting the rainforest, of course, it's desperately important for climate change with its ability to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, give out oxygen, protect what we call the ecosystem services of the forest, but, you know, clean water and air and protecting soil erosion. But for me, it's more than that. It's protecting something which, for me, is a connection to some great spiritual power. And that's why I have such affinity with the indigenous people around the world. We feel the same about the forest.
Anyone who was in the room was incredibly moved by that. And I think it was a little glimmer of the power of amidst, you know, all of these grand speeches and proclamations of tapping into emotions and tapping into, I think, the real, I guess, you know, real fear that people have that we're not going to get this figured out fast enough, despite all of the great activism that's happening out there and all the great commitment. So obviously, activism is one way that I deal with my eco-anxiety, that I channel it into trying to do good work for the world. But obviously, like, not everybody can get there, again, because I think they can find all of this so overwhelming. And Renee did a really nice job of breaking this down, of when people are confronted with the understanding of what's happening to the world, whether it's species extinction or climate change or all the plastic in the ocean or whatever it might be. When people are confronted with this, we take these scary issues and our role in them. And then she broke them down into these three A's that I found super helpful. So let me share that with you. So the first A, when we're confronted with this big, scary information, is anxiety, of course. So let's listen to that part of our conversation.
So what does this mean? What does this mean for me? This is really intense. I don't know what to, you know, how to deal with this. This is overwhelming. I'm just one person. You know, all that kind of anxiety that can come up. And then there's ambivalence. That's the second A, which is huge. And I would love us to spend more time really understanding and working with ambivalence, which is part of me wants to do this and part of me doesn't. And that's really huge. It's really what I believe keeps a lot of people stuck in an inactive paralysis place, which, again, you know, I think if we understand how to work with people's ambivalence, we can unlock a lot of capacities.
Okay, so you've got anxiety and then ambivalence. What's the third A?
Aspiration.
And so the climate movement, the environmental movement, tends to only focus on aspiration. And personally, we feel that we should be doing that. Like, oh, I want to stay positive. I want to stay connected with my aspiration. But actually, from a, you know, psychological perspective, that's not totally, you know, it's not a grounded place to be coming from. Who is only aspirational all the time? So where I'm coming from with the three A's is first to tune into our own three A's, which is to notice, where am I having anxiety? Where's my ambivalence? Where's my aspiration? And to be very compassionate with ourselves about wherever we are, and to just stop beating up ourselves about what we're doing, what we're not doing. That's actually really not helpful. And it's just unfair to ourselves, because we are where we are and we're part of a much bigger system. And I think a lot of energy around the self-beratement and I could be doing more is actually, it's pretty damaging. So having compassion for the anxiety, ambivalence, and really tuning into where your aspiration is, so that we start to practice a more integrated approach.
I love that. It's really interesting just thinking about how these three A's have played out in my life, both personally and professionally. I think for a long time, I, like most in the climate movement, was just like fully bought into aspiration and, you know, just really threw myself into my work in climate activism as my way of psychologically grappling with this, of giving the world something I thought that was positive and hopefully was positive. But I did it at the expense of not addressing the other two issues. So I just kind of buried those, the anxiety and the ambivalence. And I really did kind of have to come to a breaking point where almost like I was like, I can't keep still being aspirational. Like, I can't keep pouring all of my energy into my work, into activism. Like, I have to take a step back and wrestle with the anxiety and these other complicated emotions.
Just to springboard off of that, I think that for me personally, it shows up a little bit less as anxiety per se, but more of the, because I am an incredibly aspirational, ambitious person. And like, I do believe there's a pathway to solve this problem. And I'm throwing everything I can into realizing that. It's the having that not be grounded. There is a lot of, I should be doing more, kind of beating myself up. Like, I should, this isn't happening fast enough. And that definitely spoke to me. I was like, oh yeah, raising my hand over here as one of those people who feels that every day. So, you know, I think the bottom line for Renee is that acknowledging and just letting yourself actually experiencing your feelings, whatever they are, however sort of intense they are on the spectrum, but just not sort of boxing them up or compartmentalizing them is key, because that opens you up to coping with them yourself and also connecting better with other people. So let's listen to her talk about that a little bit.
And I still feel that no matter what mode that is for you, whether it's through whatever expressive way, talking with people, writing, you know, singing, painting, whatever that is, the ability to take your experience and then communicate that is very transformative. It's very healing. It helps us remember we're not alone. It can shift the energy from feeling stuck to feeling activated. It can actually open up to ourselves more possibility and reflection on what other ways we might be able to plug in and engage.
Yeah, and that was something really powerful for me, was that this wasn't just about sitting quietly in a room, you know, getting in touch with your emotions, but this actually could make the actions that we take more effective and more powerful because they're grounded in these emotions that are actually something that connects us with other people, instead of just jumping into the to-do list, into the aspiration that are the actions that we take, if they're grounded here in the other two A's, can in the anxiety and the ambivalence actually can have more impact. And another just last takeaway that was really powerful for me were her thoughts about being vulnerable, which again, as a leader in the climate world, is something I frankly find a little daunting sometimes. But it goes hand in hand with confronting our eco-anxiety, which is just sharing it with others. So let's hear a little more about that.
I mean, I can't say enough about how powerful vulnerability really is, and that if more leaders and more people who are out there on the front lines can show up fully in our vulnerability to be really open and honest to say, look, you know, I'm feeling pretty freaked out right now, but yet I'm standing here and I'm still doing this work. It's relatable. It's really, it's a basis for building trust and building connection.
And Anna Jane, you did that when you were going through the hurricane. And I just really have always admired that about you, and definitely admired it this summer.
Thank you. That means a lot. I mean, vulnerability is really, really scary. And being public about your struggles doesn't come easy to me at all. But I've found so much courage and strength in connecting with other people. When I found that being vulnerable has allowed me to connect with so many other people who are on this journey, and to share solidarity and support and tips on how to navigate it. And I want to be human and real and vulnerable in how I, you know, fight climate change. I actually think it kind of requires that. At least I know it does for me. And I've also, it has brought a lot of healing. I'm in a much, much better place right now than I was, you know, a year ago. And I think part of that was just being real with myself and being real with others. So thank you.
Well, and that's what we're going to do this whole season of No Place Like Home, which I'm so excited about. We really want to go there. You know, we want to go there on the emotional and the psychological and the spiritual landscape of climate change, because both in part because we know this is hard stuff to hear and process. I mean, we both struggle with it every day, but also because as Renee mentioned in the interview, when we don't connect with it, the actions that we take aren't as powerful. We're missing a key thread of our work when we don't tap into these deeper veins. So we want to find more ways to talk about it, and we want to find new angles to explore it. And we're going to bring all that to you this season.
Yeah, we're going to look at how eco-anxiety affects kids. We're going to explore spirituality and eco-anxiety.
Yes, I just had the most incredible conversation with Karenna Gore, Al Gore's daughter and a leader on faith and climate change, about that. And
We have episodes about strength and art and courage and humor in the face of climate change and eco-anxiety. And it's just going to be a really rich, really deep, hopefully kind of surprising and innovative season of conversations.
So stay tuned, y'all. We're so glad to be back with you. And we can't wait to share our next episode coming soon. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and we will be posting all episodes and updates and information on our Twitter page at NPLH Podcast. So be sure to follow us there.
Tweet at us. Again, we're at NPLH Podcast.
And remember, there is no place like home.
That was Anna Jane Joyner and Marianne Hitt and their helpful podcast, No Place Like Home. Get it free on iTunes. I'll put links in my blog.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Now we get the latest on the Extinction Rebellion, courtesy of Rob Muir and his show, Environmental Dialogues.
Welcome to Moyer's Environmental Dialogues, Ocean River Shields of Achilles, with your host, Dr. Rob Muir. Find out what others are doing and what you can do to create a greener and blue planet Earth. Now, here's Dr. Rob Muir.
Welcome. Welcome. Today, we are talking about the Extinction Rebellion. This is a new movement that's gathering and heading up steam to stave off the Anthropocene extinction, and what this involves and what's happening with this group that is getting a big name for itself is going to be the focus of today's episode. And I'm grateful for the presence of Rupert Reed is going to be with us. And Rupert is a reader of philosophy at the University of East Anglia, chair of the UK-based think tank Greenhouse, and a former Green Party of England and Wales councillor, spokesperson, European parliamentary candidate, and national parliamentary candidate as well. Hello, Rupert.
Hello there.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. Where are you calling us from?
Well, I live in Norwich, in the heart of East Anglia, but I'm actually calling you from Cambridge, where I've just launched my new book on film and philosophy and ecology.
Congratulations. Our other guest is Dr. Alison Green, is a UK cognitive psychologist in the area of human learning and skill acquisition. Alison is the former pro vice chancellor at Arden University. Okay, Alison. Alison and I are working together on a number of projects. So, but I got to ask you for the public, why former?
Hi, everyone. Former because I took a very large decision a couple of months ago to resign from my post and swap academia for full-time activism.
Yeah, it's just remarkable, you know, because I look at your resume and you've been doing all these steps, getting higher and higher and doing more and more in academia, and then you just stepped away. Why?
Yeah, I guess I had a kind of epiphany a couple of years ago, and I got to a point in my career where suddenly I realized that actually the career didn't really matter, and what really mattered to me was putting myself into something that I actually believe in and something that enabled me to maintain my integrity. And so I wanted to leave the system, basically. I wanted to extricate myself from the current economic system as best I could. And do something that I can believe in.
And so what did you come up with to do?
Well, I became involved with Extinction Rebellion, which began its life formally late last year, although the ideas had been in development with the key founders of the group for quite some time. So that's Roger Hallam and Gail Bradbrook, I think, are the two people that were most closely associated with Extinction Rebellion. These guys really motivated and inspired me and led me to want to work with them and to bring about social change.
Yes, exactly. And so that's why you're featured on this show to talk about the Extinction Rebellion. We're really glad to have you, Allison. I also want to introduce Isabel Ronowski. Isabel just graduated last month from Wellesley College, and she's in here working as one of our spring semester interns. Hello, Isabel. And Hunter Lambert is at Boston University. Hi, Hunter.
Hello, everyone.
Allison, I kind of cut you off, and you were telling us about how the Extinction Rebellion came to be. Tell us about the roots.
It started some time ago, I think, with Gail primarily, who had been an activist and who had been trying to facilitate and encourage mass civil disobedience. And then last year, things seemed to gel. And so in October, on October 31st last year, there was a declaration in London. And this was then followed by a number of events in London. The movement is unusual in that it's grown remarkably quickly, but it has at its core some principles that I think will resonate really with a lot of people. And they're things like telling the truth about climate and the ecological emergency. You know, and I think most people can identify with that because, you know, the truth is absolutely fundamental. You know, what is wrong with telling the truth? A second requirement is that the government enacts legally binding policy measures. And then a third one is that we bring about a citizens' assembly to oversee changes as part of a sort of creating a democracy. And those are the three core principles that I think have really sparked the imagination of a lot of people, from academics to young people to grandparents. They're the kinds of things that people can really buy into and really believe in.
Can I just add that the demand for legally binding policy measures, it's the precise demand in the UK context, and I think it would be similar in the US context, is for this country to go carbon net zero by 2025, which is an incredibly bold demand. It looks completely unrealistic according to the rules of the political system as we know it. It requires everything to be changed in a short space of time. But that is actually what we need. This is one of my favorite demands that we in Extinction Rebellion are making. We're saying, yes, everything has to change really fast. And that's why we need to do really radical things to get there. It's not going to happen if we just stick to the conventional political process. It's not going to happen if we just stick to trying to vote for the best candidates at elections. That can help, but it isn't going to get us to zero carbon by 2025. So I think that demand of the Extinction Rebellion really concentrates the mind and really shows why we need to be engaging in mass civil disobedience.
Yes, I'm glad to see that you are quite clear about what kind of strategies to get there in terms of, you're not saying the ends justifies any means. You have some discipline. And
so nonviolence is completely central to the movement. And as Alison just said, also, we want democracy. We want real democracy. We're saying that representative democracy, as we know it, has failed. So let's have some citizens' democracy. Let's have some sortition is the technical term for it. It's like what you do with a jury. A jury is selected at random from members of the public. We should have a citizens' assembly like that, where people are selected at random to represent us all, as a jury does. And then they're given some help and some education and some information and facilitated in deliberating about what we should do. Frankly, they couldn't do any worse than the current bunches of politicians we've got in our countries. So let's give that kind of radical version of democracy, let's give that kind of idea a chance.
So that means you have to be open to diverse approaches to getting there. You're not just all walking step in the same, you know, kind of together. I mean, that you're trying to be a big tent, right, and involve different views and stuff.
Yeah, and you're trying to open to new and radical possibilities. Of course, a lot of what we do is going to have to be done by really, really working together, more closely together than we ever have done before. We have to want to do that. We have to do it more or less voluntarily. That's what real democracy means, and that's part of what Extinction Rebellion wants to facilitate, real democracy and nonviolent rule of the people, by the people, for the people.
And we're going to get into that, about how you're really receptive to letting people express it in a local way. Does that, nothing influences local decision makers better than someone who sounds like their mother or, you know, takes the approach that really catches their attention. Oh, over to you, Isabel. I'm going to have a question.
Allison, you mentioned earlier that there were some events organized in London. Can you tell us the first big action taken there as part of the Extinction Rebellion mission and movement?
And for me, this was a first too. So I participated in what we're calling the Bridges event. And this took place on November 17th in London. And, you know, this was a big ambition. So the plan was that people would descend upon London and we would arrange ourselves on five bridges simultaneously. And then when a signal was given, we would then just swarm into the roads and we would just stop. We would simply stop the traffic. And, you know, for a lot of people there, you know, I was there on the day on Waterloo Bridge. I know Rupert was there too. Being there and actually talking with the people about why they were there and their motivations and what mattered to them was, you know, was really quite an incredible experience. You know, the UK hasn't seen this kind of action, this kind of commitment from normal people to simply congregate and to actually take action, non-violent action in this particular way. We haven't seen this kind of thing in a long, long time. So it was quite an experience, I have to say, you know, to actually just be there and then to look across the Thames, across to the other bridges. The atmosphere was quite euphoric in a way, which sort of seems somehow not quite appropriate for an event that was a very serious event. I mean, these were people who are passionate, absolutely passionate about what's happening in the UK and across the globe, and who are saying, you know, we've had enough. We are going to rise up and we are going to make ourselves heard. It was a very empowering experience from my perspective. And Rupert, I know you were there. Perhaps you want to say something too?
Yeah, well, my experience was very similar. I was on Lambeth Bridge and I was helping to try to sort of organise the taking of the bridge. The atmosphere before we tried to go into the road, frankly, it was pretty nervous. I was really quite uncertain that it was going to work out. And then Roger Hellam, who was on Lambeth Bridge with me and one or two of the others, started walking out into the road. He just started strolling into the road and then we all started following. And we just found how incredibly easy it was for hundreds of us to occupy this bridge and stop the traffic, bring central London to a standstill, reduce economic activity, and how the police couldn't really stop us because there were so many of us. And as you say, Alison, part of the atmosphere was, as a result of this, euphoria. It's like, wow, we can do it. 6,000 people took non-violent civil disobedience and occupied the bridges of central London. And if we've done that once, well, we can do it again, and we can do it again on an even larger scale. And that is indeed what we're planning to do in April.
Yeah, and I recommend people go to your website.
The correct website address is simply rebellion.earth.
If you want to follow along with what Alison and Rupert are talking about, it's a great site to visit. Oh, Alison, you had an event that involved burying a coffin?
It did. So November 17th was really a very symbolic event. It was about expressing feelings, expressing anger. The following event on November 24th in Parliament Square was really, it was a grieving event. It was where people came together to talk about their feelings, to talk about how we feel about, you know, the loss of the Arctic sea ice, the loss of so many species. Oh, you know, it's tragic to how we feel about the forthcoming loss of even more species. And Skeena Rathor has been, sort of, in many ways, you know, the heart and soul of Extinction Rebellion. And she talked very passionately and emotionally about how one of the hardest things she'd had to do was explain to her teenage daughter that she might not have the longevity that she would wish for. And hearing these impassioned speeches from various people, Rupert spoke too, it was incredibly moving. And it culminated in there was a march and there was also a symbolic burial of a coffin. These kinds of actions where people talk about, you know, about feelings, where there's a deep kind of spiritual core to the movement, this is incredibly unusual. This hasn't really been seen before.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think this is a unique dimension of Extinction Rebellion. We're giving people a space which is so needed for the expression of feelings of grief and loss and terror. And these things have been suppressed in the environmental movement far too often. The environmental movement for far too long has said things like, oh, we have to be optimistic. We always have to give people something positive to look towards. And it means that we've been very inauthentic often in the environmental movement. The Extinction Rebellion is blowing through all of that. We're saying, stuff that. Let's be honest. It's time to tell the truth, which is the demand we're also making, as Alison said, of the government. So we had better do it ourselves. It's time to tell the truth about our fears. It's time to tell the truth about our feelings. It's time to tell the truth about what we want. And what we actually find is that liberates people and empowers people to become much stronger and much less fearful. And it leads people, for example, to make the extraordinary, brilliant decision that Alison has made, which has really made me think, I must tell you, of chucking in this amazing job that she has so that she can try to do the right thing for the future of the planet. It's a liberation that's going along with this kind of authenticity and this facing of the reality of what we've done. You know, the horrendous fact that during my lifetime, we have exterminated half of wildlife on Earth. Mind-blowing, terrible fact. If you don't feel really sad when you hear that statistic, there's something wrong with you. So there has to be a place in our movement for that sadness. And in Extinction Rebellion, there definitely has been. And November the 24th, as Alison says, was a superb expression of that. It's called Rebellion Day 2, if people want to look it up on the internet.
Well, I'm tempted to call for a moment of silence, but instead, we have to take a break. And we'll be right back to talk some more with Rupert and Alison about Extinction Rebellion.
Radio EcoShock.
You can also send an email to rob@oceanriver.org. Now, back to Dr. Rob Moyer.
Hi, we're talking, we being Hunter Isabel and I, are talking about the Extinction Rebellion with Rupert Reed and Alison Green, who are calling in from the UK. And Rupert, what's the website for people to follow, learn more about Extinction Rebellion?
The correct website address is simply rebellion.earth.
I think, Hunter, we got a question.
I know we touched on some events earlier regarding the bridge blocking and symbolic burial of Coffin, but we also hit on the idea of doing things at a local level. Do you guys want to talk about what Extinction Rebellion is doing with local communities?
Locally, I think it must be around about 200 now Extinction Rebellion groups around the UK, and you know, globally, it's spreading really, really quickly too. Just to give you an example, in Cambridge, which is where I also happen to be, we had an event just before Christmas, which was really quite remarkable. 200 people just congregated in town, and we marched through town, and we did a number of actions. Again, these are all non-violent actions, very symbolic, very moving. We staged a die-in in a large shopping arcade, which is really, really quite something to just sort of lie down on the ground in a large shopping arcade. People haven't seen that kind of thing before, certainly not around here. And then in the market square, we had a number of people, including myself, just talking to people, not just to the people who were part of the action that day, but talking to members of the public too, and trying to say to people, you know, what's happening isn't acceptable. You know, we have to stand together. We have to rise up. We have to take action. We have to make some very simple, basic demands that aren't contentious, asking governments to tell the truth. You know, it's not what they're used to doing. It's what we should be doing. We had the action in Cambridge. We had another one recently where we staged a bike ride. I mean, Cambridge is Cycle City. And this was a bike ride unlike any other, in that we were actually going. I wasn't part of that one on that occasion. And people were cycling very, very, very slowly through town. What I like about these regional events is that they have their own regional identity. People are doing things that are kind of appropriate for their city or where they happen to be. People are being creative. People are thinking about what they can do and how they can make a difference. And, you know, I think, you know, I've used the word empowering before already, but it's incredibly empowering for people to feel that they can do something and then to see that they're making a real difference.
That's my perspective from Norwich, which is very much in line with what Alison's saying. It's important to understand that Extinction Rebellion is quite a decentralist organisation. So local groups, local affinity groups and local groups generally have a strong right to do whatever they want, provided they stay within the overall frame of the principles of Extinction Rebellion, and especially the fundamental method of nonviolence. So where I live in Norwich, we've been very active. We occupied and blocked a exhibition where the local council were trying to promote a horrible new climate dangerous road that they want to build. We nonviolently protested there and effectively blocked this exhibition from happening. We've also been working hard to try to persuade our local councils to declare a climate emergency, which is happening as a result of Extinction Rebellion in more and more places around Britain and, in fact, around the world. these local events are happening all over the place, as Alison says, more and more of them. And then there are also going to be the big national and indeed international events, with the key one being on April the 15th, which everyone is working towards.
Right. We'll come back to the April event later in the show when we're urging people to join with, you know, sign up for your website and stuff, because we want to get people involved with that. But before then, I want to talk a bit about, you know, how you guys are working the media to get the word out. Alison, there was a letter from academics that you could maybe start us off on, and then Rupert could comment on that as well.
Yeah, one of the things that I think has been hugely effective in terms of getting Extinction Rebellion on the radar and bringing awareness to it was the initial letter that Rupert, Richard House and I composed. You know, and we composed the letter, and it's a, if you look at it, it's on the Guardian website. It's very visceral, you know, because we are all, the three of us, incredibly passionate about what's happening and what's not happening, and just how important it is that, you know, that that action is taken. And so, being academics, you know, we thought, well, academics need to have a voice. You know, the public trust, they trust academics, they tend to trust experts. So we reached out to our academic networks across a huge number of different disciplines. So we weren't reaching out simply to climate scientists. We were reaching out to people from the arts and the humanities, sciences and theology, philosophy, you know, a broad church. It was remarkable because, you know, people would, you know, willingly sign up, many of them saying, fantastic, you know, we really support what you're doing. It's about time. We've needed this. And that letter was really a turning point for Extinction Rebellion. It was cathartic. It's proven to be a catalyst. It's had that letter has had some 16,000 downloads, I think, from The Guardian, which is, you know, if you think of it, this is it, in one sense, it's just a letter. In another sense, I think it marked a point at which academics were saying, we are no longer sitting on the fence. You know, we are standing up and we're going to make our voices heard.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we then followed that up with a second letter in December, which was an international letter, which was again headed up by Alison and Richard House and myself. And this international letter had a lot of signatories that your listeners will recognize, people like Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Philip Pullman, Bill McKibben, Jonathan Porritt, Lily Cole, Chris Packham, a real retinue of international stars of the green movement and of broadcasting and of media and of dissent. And what this international letter did was follow on the initial letter and say, look, this obviously is something of concern to us around the world. And around the world, we need organizations, we need movements like Extinction Rebellion to be taking off in a big way if we are to have a future. It really is as simple and as blunt as that. We're delighted that these letters seem to have had this kind of involving and catalyzing effect upon people. And that's part of the reason, I think, why we are seeing this extraordinary international development of Extinction Rebellion. I think officially now there are groups in 127 countries, which is really quite incredible. And what we're hoping, among other things, is that in the US, Extinction Rebellion is really going to grow and take off in the next few months and hopefully rise to the kind of level that it's already risen to in Britain.
Yes, I see signs of that happening here from my Boston perspective. You guys have really set a great trend. There was a letter with the BBC in London.
I think you might be referring there to the letter that I coordinated, which happened a month or two earlier, where we, a bunch of us, got together to lobby the BBC to essentially say that it's completely inappropriate for them to have a so-called balanced debate between climate scientists and so-called climate skeptics, i.e. climate change deniers. And the BBC then changed their policy, and the BBC have actually moved in the right direction here. And the BBC now say they will no longer feature these kind of climate change deniers as balance. And this obviously is a real step forward. And obviously that's something which you badly need in America, but it's much more difficult for you in America when you have the unfortunate position that your so-called president is himself one of those completely absurd deniers. But hopefully before too long, the US will be catching up with us on that. and following the practice of the BBC, which, as I say now, is to not feature climate change deniers anymore. The BBC has accepted the reality of climate change, human anthropogenic deadly climate change, and this is a significant step forward.
Yes, we had a significant step in Washington just 2 days ago when, now that the Democrats control the House of Representatives, the House Committee on Natural Resources could recognize climate change and had Massachusetts Republican governor, one of the most popular governors in the country, go to Washington and explain how we must address climate change. So the chairman of that committee was wise enough not to have a Democrat telling Republicans why they should do this, but to have the Republican governor and a Republican representative from Florida, South Florida, to talk about, hey, you know. So, yes, we've got a bumpkin at the top, and fortunately, you know, the Democrats have taken back the House, and that gives us a crowbar into doing this kind of legislation things. Let's kick back a bit, and Rupert, tell us about kind of the philosophical underpinnings of this whole kind of, these kind of endeavors of trying to repair nature and how complicated it all is.
Well, there's so much to say here, but let me just mention a couple of key things. Firstly, as we've already implied, and this is a very important point, the Extinction Rebellion is not just about dangerous man-made climate change. It's not just about climate breakdown. It's about the wider ecological crisis, of which climate breakdown is simply the biggest and most immediately existentially threatening symptom for us, for humans. But we have to remember that actually the extinction crisis and the biodiversity crisis are hitting already the planet unbelievably hard and rendering other species extinct at an almost unprecedented rate. And this is all down to us, and mostly not down to climate, actually. It's mostly down to habitat destruction and sheer human numbers and level of human consumption and production and pollution more generally. Extinction Rebellion is concerned about the possible extinction of the human race and the actual extinction of other beings across our planet. And we want absolutely to stop both of these things. That's the first point. The second point is that part of what is needed in order for us to make this kind of massive shift, this shift in our practices and shift in our mindset, is for us to move to what's called a more precautionary approach, which is what is really called for by proper science and certainly by proper philosophy and proper ethics. And what precaution says is you shouldn't have to wait until all the evidence is in about something terrible that we're doing before you move to act on it. The demand to have full evidence, full proof that things are just as terrible as we say they are, is actually a demand for prevarication. It's actually an excuse for inaction. We need to act ahead of certainty to protect things which are at terrible risk of being destroyed while we try to wait to accumulate the evidence that goes to make up that certainty. And that kind of action on the basis of probabilities, on the basis of our exposure to risk, rather than on the basis of absolute certainty, that is precaution. That is what's known as the precautionary principle. And that precautionary principle is a key part of the motivation for Extinction Rebellion. It needs to be a key part of the way we rethink what we're doing across the whole piece here. And so for that reason, for example, in our first letter, the academic's letter that Alison mentioned, we highlighted the precautionary principle and said, if we really operated on the basis of precaution, if we stopped being so reckless with our common future, well, then we actually would have a chance of reining in the destruction that we're reining at present in time.
Rupert, thank you for taking time away from all your other stuff to tell us about the Extinction Rebellion. Alison, thank you. We've run out of time, so I have to cut you off right there. Thank you very much for spending the time to explain all the good work that you're doing with the Extinction Rebellion.
Thank you. You're all very welcome.
And all you listeners, thank you for listening this week. Please tune in next week. And just take care, and take care of yourselves, and then try to take a moment to take care of this planet Earth of ours. Thanks a lot.
Sadly, we are out of time. You can find Rob's full 52-minute broadcast with more from Alison Green and Dr. Rob Muir at oceanriver.org. To get this and other free podcasts, click on radio at oceanriver.org or listen to the Voice America Variety Channel live every Thursday at 12 noon Pacific Time. I hope Greta Thunberg gets that Nobel Peace Prize. Thousands of people in over 100 countries joined her school strike on Friday, March 15th. Now, we need the parents to listen and start acting to save our future. We're out of time here on Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.